From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, opera's crossover star Dawn Upshaw. She's currently performing at the Met in The Marriage of Figaro, and she has a new album of obscure Broadway songs. Also today, searching for a meaning that would defeat death, we talk with writer Ian Fraser about the family history he began after the death of his parents. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by the young alto saxophonist Abraham Burton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Investigators have recovered the voice and flight data recorders from the American Eagle commuter plane that crashed yesterday in Indiana. Officials hope they'll offer clues to what happened moments before the plane went down. Shirley Jihad of member station WBEZ reports.
Officials are beginning the painstaking work of sifting through the debris following the crash that eyewitnesses say left the plane and everything in it shredded. Part of the process involves leaving all of the pieces in place, though, as investigators try and determine what happened. Mel Carraway is the director of the Indiana Emergency Management Agency.
The wreckage is strewn over a large area. However, just because of that happening, someone's going to have to come back and put it all together.
Officials say the somber task of removing remains from the scene could take as long as a week. For National Public Radio, I'm Shirley Jihad in Roselawn, Indiana.
Baltimore fire officials say a possible tornado has damaged hundreds of homes and businesses. City Fire Chief Hector Torres says the storm blew the roofs off hundreds of row houses and small businesses. Cars were smashed and trees downed. Witnesses reported seeing a funnel cloud, but the National Weather Service hasn't confirmed this. There are no immediate reports of injury. The Senate Intelligence Committee is blasting CIA Director James Woolsey. The lawmakers say he was too easy on the CIA officials who failed to detect Aldrich Ames and his sale of secrets to the Soviet Union for more than 9 years. NPR's Melinda Penkava reports.
Since Ames' arrest in February, the question has been how the CIA officer could go undetected for so long. The intelligence panel is pointing fingers at the very top of the CIA. Former directors, such as William Casey, are blamed for not suspecting a mole in the mid-80s when many of the CIA's contacts in the Soviet Union suddenly disappeared. The panel also rebukes the current director for only issuing letters of reprimand to those CIA employees the agency itself said were to blame. James Woolsey defends his approach, saying it is time to put the case behind us. He says his agency has put in place or is about to most of the intelligence panel's recommendations. The committee says the agency should tighten computer security and suspend any CIA officer who, like Ames did, shows signs of a drinking problem. I'm Melinda Penkava in Washington.
Gulf War allies are sending a strong message to Iraq. More than 100 Allied warplanes buzzed southern Iraq and northern Kuwait today. Two U.S. B-52 bombers led the armada. The exercise was intended to show Allied resolve to protect Kuwait. Baghdad is calling the action provocative. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 45 points to 3,863. This is NPR. A federal judge in Miami has found cable news network guilty of criminal contempt of court. Judge William Hoover says CNN willfully violated his order not to broadcast conversations between former Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega and his lawyers. The conversations were taped in 1990. Judge Hoover had imposed a gag order and warned that broadcasting the tapes would violate that order. CNN had argued it was legally entitled to air the leaked tapes and had a journalistic responsibility to do so. The network faces a fine of up to $100,000. The Federal Communications Commission is gearing up for the next round of spectrum auctions on December 5th. Companies are bidding for the right to build new wireless networks and compete head-on with both existing cellular networks and the traditional wired phone system. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
74 companies have signaled their intention to take part in the December 5th auction. They range from big players like AT&T, Macaw, and Sprint to smaller groups concentrating on licenses in particular cities. The previous auctions have brought in $1 billion for the federal treasury. Robert Pepper, the director of the FCC Planning Office, isn't offering any guesses about how much the December auction will bring in.
And one of the interesting things we found out at the nationwide narrowband auction is those who know we're not talking, and those who are talking either didn't know or didn't want us to know. One of the nice things about the auction, we just wait long enough, we hold the auction, and we see what the results are.
FCC Chairman Reed Hunt says just the anticipation of new competition from auction winners has already resulted in lower prices for cellular phone service. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
A Russian commission fears a huge oil spill may get worse with spring flooding. The panel investigating the spill near the Arctic Circle is urging authorities to clean up the oil before the spring thaw and rains. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When an opera singer takes on Broadway songs, it often means trouble. That's why Dawn Upshaw's new recording is such a surprise. Then again, Upshaw is such an unassuming opera singer, headlines have referred to her as the undiva and the diva next door. Her new album features songs by Leonard Bernstein, Mark Blitzstein, Stephen Sondheim, and Kurt Weill. She's already won 2 Grammy Awards for her 1989 album of songs by Samuel Barber and John Harbison, and her 1991 album, The Girl with Orange Lips, featuring songs by Ravel and Stravinsky. Upshaw is currently performing at the Met in The Marriage of Figaro. Her new album, I Wish It So, is likely to expand her audience to include fans of music theater. Here she is singing the title track.
An unrest inside me. Oh, it's long I have had such an unrest inside me, and it's getting real bad. I'm sleeping at night, and my heart beats so loud that I wake all dizzy and light with a dreaming and feeling this. Such a thumping inside me that I think I'll go mad. For I wish it so, what I wish I still don't know, but it's bound to come, though so long to wait.
Dawn Upshaw, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Now, the song that we just heard is by Mark Blitzstein, who I know basically from, you know, as the translator of Brecht's lyrics for the Three Penny Opera. I know he wrote The Cradle Where Rocks. I don't know the music. And this is such a beautiful song. It was really a revelation to me to hear it. So first I want to thank you for recording it and then for doing it so well. What made you choose this?
Well, I had heard it on a recording when I was became interested in looking into some Mark Blitzstein music. I heard a recording of lots of different songs, and this one touched me more than any other, and has become quite an important song altogether for me. I think it has a wonderful message, and that's why I really chose it to sort of open the entire recording and gave the recording this title.
How did you narrow down your record to 4 composers?
We thought it might be interesting to take these 4 composers who had all written for opera and music theater and had similar things in common in terms of their backgrounds and what they were trying to do in American music theater. So the challenge was narrowing down all the songs because there are so many wonderful songs. But we did want to choose maybe, for the most part, some that hadn't been heard all that often.
I'm one of the people who gets kind of scared when I hear that an opera singer is going to do Broadway songs. Because with the exception of say, Eileen Farrell, so many opera singers have stiff phrasing and very pretentious pronunciations, and they seem to almost be condescending to the material. Mm-hmm. And you sing with a directness and a colloquialism that I think, you know, pop or Broadway really requires, but you have the sureness of a wonderful and trained singer. Were you used to singing this material?
I did a fair amount of it, you know, in high school, but I'm sure most of my colleagues did. I guess I've always tried to stick close to my love for lyrics and for words. And sometimes I think that perhaps I'm viewed by my own audiences in opera and in the classical world as being a little too relaxed in that sense. And maybe I was able to approach these words a little bit more naturally and comfortably because of that. But I really do always work from the text, and that's what brings me to new music, that my interest in a particular song.
Let me pause here to play another of the songs from your new album. Why don't we hear That's Him, which is a collaboration between Kurt Weill and Ogden Nash. Tell me why you chose this song.
I love these lyrics. They're so much fun. And I just thought it was a beautiful, you know, an old gem, kind of in just a wonderful style that I actually miss nowadays in songs. I didn't know this song before. My friend Tommy Krasker showed it to me, and I fell in love with it, had to do it.
Okay, I'm glad you did. This is Dawn Upshaw from her new album, I Wish It So.
You know the way you feel when there is autumn in the air. That's him, that's him. The way you feel when Antoine has finished with your hair. That's him, that's him. You know the way you feel when you smell bread baking, the way you feel when suddenly a tooth stops aching. Wonderful world, wonderful you. That's him, that's him. As a swim in summer.
Dawn Upshaw, do you think you use your voice differently when you're singing Broadway songs and when you're singing opera? Is there a different range, for instance, that you're in?
Oh, definitely. A much different vocal range. Just in terms of the lower... It's a much lower range. I'm using more of my middle and lower notes than I do in opera and other classical music. But I really like to think that in terms of producing the sound, I'm not doing much differently. I think what is the primary difference is the way I use words and perhaps use the consonants and the vowels in order to sound as natural as possible. Now, hearing myself say that, I think, geez, I should do that all the time, whether I'm singing classical music or music theater. But anyway, I felt like everything needed to be very accessible, the diction especially.
So what's the difference between the way you pronounce consonants and vowels in opera and the way you do with music theater?
I guess I give myself a little bit more liberty in the music theater to express and maybe spend a little bit more time on consonants, for instance. It becomes more important, depending on what style you're singing in, but say Mozart, to sing more legato, and so much of the way the music is written and a phrase is turned depends on singing on vowel longer than necessarily, you know, playing with consonants.
Yeah, I think a lot of classical singers are appalled at the way pop singers sing the consonants. Mm-hmm. I mean, consonants are supposed to just end the vowel, right?
Well, except I find that it's the consonants that really make a singer, you know, individual from another singer, because you can be so expressive with a consonant. I find that it's much more difficult to be expressive with a vowel, you know.
Is there any way you could demonstrate for us what you mean?
Sure. One of the songs, that's him. I'm trying to say, you know the way you feel when there is autumn in the air. That's him. That's him. And when I sing that's him, I think that the M can show everybody how much I love him. I can enjoy, almost like I'm eating a delicious fruit. I can enjoy that M. And what I might do if it were Mozart, although I'm not certain about this, but I think, you know, that I might dwell more on the vowel and less on the M.
And how would that sound?
That's him. That's him. You know.
Right. Something. Right.
Much less interesting, isn't it?
I want to quote something from Opera News. The article said about you that you are one of the most hotly debated young singers. Your talent is not in question, but opinion is divided over what exactly is the best place for you, the opera or the recital hall on the concert stage. Now, that was written even before you started doing music theater repertoire. So, you know, how does it feel to be the subject of debate about where, you know, where you most belong?
Well, you know, if I can get people out of any kind of funk that might be out there and thinking a little bit differently, I'm happy for it. I think that sometimes the classical music world and the opera world can be a little bit stiff, and I have trouble with it myself sometimes. So if this challenges them at all, that's fine with me.
I imagine people are kind of competing for your attention now, in the sense that, like, I want to urge you to do more material, like on your new album, you know, more music theater material, whereas I'm sure opera fans are trying to pull you more in an opera direction.
It's difficult. I mean, I think when you say that about my family, my parents grew up much more with folk music and music theater. In fact, they were involved and sort of dragged me along to do some community theater when I was living at home, at least. And they were involved in musicals. And so when I went off into the classical world, they were very good about trying to follow and keep up with me and stuff. But once I did this recording, you know, I could tell they felt like, oh, you've come back home to us. And, you know, this is it. This is the recording we've been waiting for, which leaves me feeling a little bit funny sometimes.
How so?
Well, I think, you know, I love my work. I don't pick up any project that I'm not very interested in and committed to. I think what I will do is, I do love variety, and Lord knows I have a lot of variety in my life, not just musically, but in terms of my family life and my kids, and that's what makes life interesting. So I will continue to add this new music, music theater and things in that direction to my work.
Dawn Upshaw is my guest. She has a new recording of songs from Broadway called I Wish It So. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dawn Upshaw. Her new album of songs for music theater is called I Wish It So. You sing on the Symphony No. 3 by Henrik Gorecki, which was recorded, a couple of years ago? And
yes.
It became this phenomenon. It was a really big seller in the United States. It made it onto the top 10, the pop top 10 in England.
Right.
Did you have any sense that it would be that kind of phenomenon when you recorded it?
No, none at all. It was a complete surprise, really, to all of us involved, which is not to say that we didn't all have very profound experiences as we recorded it. We did. We just never expected so wide an audience in the world to have that same experience themselves.
I want to play a short excerpt of this symphony since it's sung in Polish. Tell us a little bit about what the symphony is about.
Well, it really has a lot to do with the composer, Mr. Gorecki's experience with the Second World War and all of the various people who were killed in the concentration camps. And he lived not very far from Auschwitz and had actually visited some of the camps. And as you can imagine, this had quite an effect on him. He chose some texts for this piece. It's called The Symphony of Sorrowful Songs. They're really religious texts and all have to do with loss. Two of them have to do with losing a mother losing her son, and the middle movement has to do with something he had read that was actually engraved in a prison wall by a 14-year-old girl, which stated when she had been imprisoned, and a message to her mother to please not cry for her, that Mother Mary would take care of her. And it's not known whether she survived. I think it's assumed that she did not survive, this young girl. They're very touching texts, and the music is extremely simple in a sense, but so profound and rich and expressive. And every movement is slow. And what is so amazing to me is that this is a piece that just stretches out for such a long time, and yet it has grabbed and kept and held the attention of so many listeners and has touched so many people.
Let's hear a little bit of it. This is Henryk Gorecki, Symphony No. 3. The singer is my guest, Dawn Upshaw, and we'll hear David Zinman conducting the London Sinfonietta. Dawn Upshaw performing Henryk Gorecki's Symphony No. 3. What were the first kinds of songs that you listened to as a girl?
I listened to a lot of folk music, and my father played guitar and my mother, both my parents sing a bit, and my sister and I, when we were very young, went with them, and the four of us sang for students, for little kids in school. And we always had kind of a bit of a message, and it was during the civil rights movement and in the early 60s. And that's what I grew up with, and I studied piano. I studied the oboe, and I guess it was through those two instruments that my musical background had broadened a little bit. But I didn't really hear any classical music in my home until I was ready to go to college.
I guess that's kind of late for someone who ended up singing opera.
I think so. It is a little bit late. But it's interesting because I remember the moment it all grabbed me. And it wasn't opera that grabbed me right away, but it was some very early music. I was listening to some choral music of Josquin, which is Renaissance music. And I was just blown away at how this piece had been put together. It was an onomatopoeic piece about war. And so the singers were making all of these sounds of the guns and the cannons and lots of contrapuntal writing. It was fascinating.
I know there was a time when you wanted to sing jingles.
<'Cause>, yes.
Well, because you can make a living simply that way?
Yes, it seemed pretty good to me. I was working as a secretary in a studio where they recorded jingles one summer between years in high school. And these singers would come in. I mean, they had to be able to read anything at sight, of course, and to sing in any style. Or I guess frequently they invite different singers based on what they sound like, what they need for their commercials. But they would come in, and I mean, in the matter of 15 to 30 minutes, put down a jingle, and somebody told me how much they got paid at that time, the top singers. I don't know, it was something like $500,000 a year or something. And I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, I mean, it's terrible to hear me talking this way now, but I thought, gee, that sounds like a good living to me.
was there a certain kind of jingle you could imagine yourself singing?
Well, there was one of my favorites that I heard while I was working, which is, I'll give a plug right now for Kalamazoo, Michigan. It was about Kalamazoo, and it said, "Yes, there really is a Kalamazoo, so much to offer you." And I just, I don't know, I really liked the tune, and I thought this would be really fun, you know. Somehow I got distracted. So I don't know that I would never consider doing that, but I guess other things have caught my eye since.
Oh, well, something to fall back on.
Perhaps.
Dawn Upshaw, her new recording, I Wish It So, features songs by Bernstein, Blitzstein, Sondheim, and Weill. She's currently performing at the Met in The Marriage of Figaro. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Take me to the world that's real. Show me how it's done. Teach me how to laugh.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After the death of his parents, writer Ian Fraser took solace in the things they left behind. His father's meal tickets from college, his mother's purses, and the letters they saved, which dated back as far as 1855. Coming up, Fraser tells us how these things led him to trace his family history. It's the subject of his new book, Family. And jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews Closest to the Sun, the new album by alto saxophonist Abraham Burton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The murder trial of anti-abortion activist Paul Hill is progressing. The former minister is representing himself at his trial, but he hasn't said anything. Hill is accused of killing an abortion doctor and his escort. Debbie Elliott reports from Pensacola.
Paul Hill has declined to cross-examine the state's first witnesses, who have testified they saw Hill fire two rounds from a shotgun at the Pensacola Ladies Center on July 29th. The day Dr. John Britton and James Barrett were killed. Witness David Dowell said he saw Hill walk away from the clinic with his arms outstretched, palms upward, before police arrested him.
They were about to put him in the car, and he turned to an officer and myself in our direction and said, "At least there'll be no more babies killed there today."
The court has blocked Hill from arguing that it's justified to use deadly force to save the unborn. He's already been convicted on federal clinic access charges in connection with the slayings. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Pensacola, Florida.
President Clinton has increased his campaigning against Republicans. He's on a campaign trip through the Midwest, stumping for Democratic candidates. He'll appear with two Senate hopefuls, Bob Carr in Michigan and Joel Hyatt in Ohio. Clinton is warning that a GOP takeover of Congress will result in devastating cuts in social programs. He says Republicans plan a radical attack on Social Security to pay for promised tax cuts and increased defense spending. Indian police have rescued four Western tourists, including an American, after they were kidnapped by Islamic militants. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from New Delhi.
Indian police found the four hostages chained but safe in a hideout about 100 miles northeast of New Delhi, the Indian capital. They had been kidnapped last week by a Kashmiri separatist group, one of two dozen guerrilla groups fighting for independence from India. Yesterday, the kidnappers sent photos of the four hostages held at gunpoint to the New Delhi bureaus of the BBC and the Voice of America. In a ransom note, the militants had threatened to behead the four hostages one by one unless Indian officials released 10 Kashmiri militants held in Indian jails. Early this morning, police, acting on a tip-off, raided the terrorist hideout. Two policemen and one terrorist were killed during the raid. This is Eric Weiner in New Delhi.
The government says construction spending jumped 1.6% in September. That's the biggest increase in 6 months. The Commerce Department says private buildings showed a sharp turnaround. In a second economic report, a private business group reports the nation's manufacturing sector grew in October for the 14th straight month in a row. The National Association of Purchasing Management says its purchasing index rose to its highest level since December 1978. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow lost 44.5 points to close at 3,863. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. The Supreme Court has heard a case from American Airlines. The carrier wants the justices to protect it from being sued for damages by frequent flyers in state courts. American is trying to fend off a class action lawsuit over restrictions that it imposed on its frequent flying plan 6 years ago. The carrier is the world's largest frequent flyer club, but lawyers for the passengers say the airline can be forced under state law to reimburse club members for changes that cut the value of travel miles they had saved up. North Korea has started to implement the landmark nuclear accord reached with the United States. The official North Korean Central News Agency says the 5-megawatt reactor has been closed and construction on two others has been stopped. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
Hours after North Korea had begun complying with the terms of the nuclear agreement signed 10 days ago, Pyongyang blasted the United States and South Korea for conducting joint war games. The week-long military exercises got underway in South Korea today. North Korea called the exercises a premeditated provocation and an attempt to sabotage the nuclear accord. The man who negotiated the nuclear agreement for the U.S. said in an interview today that it was the North's massing of nearly a million men along the border that was unnecessarily provocative, and Robert Gallucci called for their removal. Despite North Korea's angry outburst over the joint military exercises, it has apparently begun the long, slow process of dismantling its nuclear capability. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
The World Health Organization says moderate drinking for health reasons might not be such a good idea. The UN agency says the message of moderate drinking does not come from rigorous scientific research, but from commercial purposes instead. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After Ian Fraser's parents died, he hoped to find a meaning that would defeat their death. He hunted for that meaning in the objects they'd saved, an old hymnal, a black mesh hat veil, photographs, and letters. He hoped that by tracing each object to its source, he could find a larger meaning. He took on the mission of finding a narrative that linked together the objects his parents had saved, and to link that narrative to the larger story of American history. The result is his new family history, Family. Fraser is a regular contributor to The New Yorker and the author of Dating Your Mom and The Great Plains. When he started collecting his parents' possessions, he divided them in boxes which he labeled the Dad Museum and the Mom Museum. Suddenly he was a curator, but he had no training for this job.
I didn't know what was of value and what wasn't. I was sort of an archaeologist without any sort of direction. I just had all this stuff, and I regarded it all as artifacts, and I tried to make sense of what it was. And sometimes, after looking at something for a really long time, I would conclude that there wasn't any meaning to it really at all, except that someone had forgotten to throw it away. Other times, an object would expand in meaning and practically take over all the other meanings. So I felt the responsibility of an archaeologist or maybe a paleontologist putting something together from just a few fragments.
What kinds of things had your parents saved?
Oh, just everything. My father's meal ticket from Boys State in Columbus, Ohio in 1934. Why save the meal ticket? There were 28 out of 30 punches were punched, and two weren't. All kinds of things, programs from plays that they had seen or had been in, lots and lots of letters, as I say in the book, just a cache of letters. Going back, in some cases, there were letters that went back into the 19th century. I think the earliest actual letter that I had went back to 1855, was written in 1855. And just strange things, you know, purses. My mother saved every purse for some reason, never threw out a purse. And I was able to trace the history of purses in America from 1945 to 1988 just by lining these purses up on the floor.
Your family was part of some of the major movements in American history, the move west,
mm-hmm.
the Civil War. Your great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather.
Two greats. Mm-hmm.
Charlie Wickham became the second in command of the 55th Regiment?
That's right, the 55th Ohio Volunteer Infantry, which I read the book about the 55th, which was written in the early, in 1904. And I became so involved in this regiment. They were all guys from the Norwalk area, Norwalk, Ohio. And it was sort of a hometown regiment, and I got to feel that I knew all these guys. And when you see somebody, kind of a small-town kid, who suddenly finds himself in this unbelievable war, it was just fascinating to me. And it was also fascinating, I think, because of what those guys did. They were, many of them, very idealistic, and they truly suffered for 5 years. I can't imagine that type of suffering. And at the end, they had changed the country. They had actually done something with this suffering, and the country had done something with the suffering that it went through. And I think when you look at the country and you think, how will we ever fix all of these disastrous problems that we seem to have, and you realize we have fixed problems. We have fixed problems in the past. And so somehow it was a very hopeful saga for me to follow the Civil War.
Your great-great-grandfather survived the Battle of Chancellorsville.
Right.
This is a battle where the Union troops lost about 17,000 killed, wounded, or captured, and the Confederates
right.
about 13,000. This was just a couple of months before Gettysburg. But you write that by the time you were born, the deeds of the 55th had been forgotten. How did that make you feel to think about that, how all of that had been forgotten, something so cataclysmic, and you were born and never gave it a thought until you started investigating your family history?
I thought it should be remembered. I thought it should be revived as something people know about. The people who were born after the Civil War, I think, had had enough of it, enough of hearing about it. Just like maybe people my age got a little sick of hearing about the Depression. And I think that they assisted in forgetting it. It was just the way that you don't want to hear something from your parents all the time. I think they got a little sick of it. And when I read about the 55th and when I read about what the regiment had done in the war, it helped me to understand where I grew up a lot more, because I could see that there was a certain optimism and a certain dedication to the American idea that came from this, from their participation in the war. So also the war was just really an amazing event, and there are people who get fascinated by it, and I'm one of those people, sort of a buff.
My guest is Ian Fraser. His new book is a family history called Family. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ian Fraser, the author of a new family history called Family. Now, where did your search for your family history take you, and what are some of the things that you did during that search that were really out of character for you?
Well, it took me mainly to small towns in the Midwest and in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, places like that. It took me also to the coast, east and west, because most of my family has dispersed from the middle of the country to the edges, again following a population pattern that was big and has been big in recent times. So I went all over little towns, and what was the most out of character thing I did? I suppose for me at the time, really thinking a lot about religion. It just hadn't been part of my consciousness, really. And to read these books from the 19th century where people are disputing rather small points of Protestant belief and practice, it was sort of a mind-bending experience to try and figure out, you know, exactly what the difference between, say, the New School Presbyterians and the Old School Presbyterians, a distinction now lost, but in 1825 very important. That it was stuff like that that was really kind of confusing and hard to follow.
Yeah, well, you're right. You come from a long line of Protestants, but the portion of doubt increased down the generations. I guess you're part of the generation that has plenty of doubt.
Oh, yeah. Doubt is the new religion, I guess, or it's the new standard of something that you can count on everybody pretty much having inside them, and doubt sort of has a public persona of irony, and irony is the lingua franca of people that of many, many people. And to me, irony gets kind of old after a while. And I just wanted to see what it was like to be in this different frame of mind where doubt might perhaps be quite a bit smaller, where your faith was very strong.
You also reflect on how your ancestors rarely married outside their denomination, mm-hmm. but in your generation, everyone in your family seems to be marrying outside.
Right.
Spouses, you know, people have married spouses who are Catholic, Jewish, Italian, Greek, African. Same-faith marriages in your family now are the exception. Do you feel that that's good or bad or neutral or just a, you know, sign of the times?
Well, I think it's very good. I like it. I like variety, and I grew up, I think, in a situation where I craved more variety. So I think it's, you know, I think it's really great. It's also historically part of what happened in this century, which is the ecumenical movement, that is people sort of concentrating on what made them the same rather than what made them different. And I often felt like when I was reading 19th century newspapers, my ancestors edited the newspaper in Norwalk, Ohio, and a 19th century paper in a small town in Ohio, if a strange person came to town, there would be a little parenthesis after identifying that person by race or religion. So it would say, you know, John Martinelli, parenthesis, Italian, was in town last week for such a... Well, or, you know, Moses Smith, parenthesis, colored. Well, sometimes I would get out of the 19th century when I'd been doing really deep research. I would get out of it and return to this century with just the feeling of the greatest relief, that there's something really claustrophobic about the culture of that time. And I prefer my own time. That's the kind of irony of it, I guess, is that I envy their faith, but I prefer my time.
My guest is Ian Fraser, and he's written a family history called Family. As you wrote in your book, your whole search for family history was about trying to find a meaning that would defeat death, particularly that would defeat the death of your parents and your brother. I'd like to ask you to read a paragraph from the end of the book that has to do with whether you found that meaning or not.
My parents would accompany me through a life that would be much like theirs, and at every step, I would compare myself, especially to him, my father, would judge if I was doing better or worse than he had done at being middle class and putting kids through school and not terrorizing my family and staying between the lines while trying not to forget what it is I actually want to do. And unknown things would happen, and sooner or later I would die too. I understood that now, clearly, the way you suddenly become aware of the sky and the diving board after the person in front of you has jumped. And my kids perhaps would see me off as I had seen my parents off, or perhaps not. And soon all the people who had accompanied me through life would be gone too, and then even the people who had known us, and no one would remain on earth who had ever seen us, and those descended from us perhaps would know stories about us, perhaps once in a while they would pass by buildings where we had lived, and they would mention that we had lived there. And then the stories would fade, and our graves would go untended, and the graves of those who had tended ours would go untended, and no one would guess what it had been like to wake before dawn in our breath-warmed bedrooms as the radiators clanked and our wives and husbands and children slept. And we would move from the nearer regions of the dead who are remembered into the farther regions of the forgotten, and on past those into a space as white and big as the sky replicated forever. And all that would remain would be the love bravely expressed and the moment when you danced and your heart danced with you.
It's a really beautiful, beautiful paragraph. You know, sometimes when people do their family history, what they really want is a sense of identity, a better sense of who they are
mm-hmm.
and how they got to be who they are. Was that an issue for you?
Yeah, I think it definitely was. I think I wanted to stop any kind of slide toward forgetting. I felt like there are people who forget in every generation, and they're important. You have to have people who forget and people who throw away. Those are people who, they start fresh, and you got to start fresh all the time. But somebody's got to save and somebody's got to remember. And I feel like I remembered enough to hold us for a while and to kind of get an idea of what it was like to invent oneself here. I mean, America was just self-invention from the beginning. And this is, in a way, it's a history of an identity as it changed from sort of the founding of the country until today.
Now that your book is finished, what are you doing with your mom and dad museums?
Well, they're just still in my office. I don't know what I'll do with them. I suppose I'll just put them somewhere and keep them. And I imagine my children will not have the courage to throw them out. Although I can't quite promise that. But eventually some Genghis Khan in the line will throw everything into the flames.
So you've got the stuff just in boxes?
Yeah, it's in my office. Yeah, and it's just, and I open it up sometimes and it's all just the same stuff. I mean, looking at it and writing it down in notebooks and labeling it and everything, and it's still the same. Yeah, I mean, I didn't kind of take the magic or the energy or whatever inhabits those boxes, still inhabits it. And when you look at it, you can still get a feeling for the people who wrote these letters or who saved these things.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome.
Ian Frazier is author of the new book, Family. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on the plane crash in Indiana?
Hi, Terry. We'll have a report on what's known today about last night's air crash, an American Eagle plane that went down, killing 64 passengers and 4 crew. Christopher Joyce reports on a National Transportation Safety Board report that is almost ready for release, showing that commuter airlines are more dangerous than the national airlines, and that, in fact, regulations are more lax for the smaller carriers. Martha Raddatz on a Senate report about the CIA and the Aldridge Ames spy case. Mandalit Del Barco on Proposition 187 about immigration in California. And Robert Siegel talks with Stan Musial about learning to play the harmonica.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says there are a lot of young musicians who are supposed to know the history of the music and supposed to be able to play. Kevin says many of these musicians don't really measure up, but one who does is alto saxophonist Abraham Burton. He's played in several of bebop drummer Arthur Taylor's groups and has studied with saxophonist Jackie McLean. Here's Burton on Jackie McLean's Minor March.
Say this for Abraham Burton. He can play very fast, in the manner of 1940s bebop musicians. The boppers loved dexterity and fast thinking, but they also believed in playing ballads very slow, to find out what you had going for you besides technique and reflexes, to find out if you had good tone and depth of feeling, and if you understood melody. On Laura, Abraham Burton thinks not like an alto player, but like a tenor sax balladeer with a big soulful sound. He also gets at why jazz musicians have played Laura for 49 years. It has very nice chords, but it's also that the melody unreels the way an improvisation does. Composer David Raxon takes that great opening line and keeps reworking it. He builds the whole melody out of it. So when a jazz group plays Laura, the variations begin where the written part starts instead of where it ends. A clever soloist can use that to blur the line between what's written and improvised. That's what Abraham Burton does. He drifts slowly away from the melody like a film noir smoke ring. He preserves the mood. This Laura can remind you how great material fosters great playing. Unfortunately, musicians will settle for less. Burton's good band on his album Closest to the Sun is pianist Mark Carey, bassist Billy Johnson, and drummer Eric McPherson. Burton and company wrote more than half the pieces, and their tunes aren't nearly so rich or as stimulating to play. Some folks say jazz needs a canon of classic works, but jazz already has one. The canon is the tunes jazz musicians always play, like Body and Soul, and Cherokee, and All the Things You Are, and Laura.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. He reviewed Closest to the Sun by alto saxophonist Abraham Burton. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Cherry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writing David Caruso's last episodes on NYPD Blue, we talk with the show's creator, David Milch. And we discuss the elections with Steve Roberts of U.S. News & World Report. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.